review the calculation of the quantum correction to the Newtonian potential. So that's what I'll do. In fact, I'll not only do it once, I'll do it twice. A second technique, which I just, if people are interested in issues of quantum mechanics and gravity, you might find using a second approach also. But then more of the point of it, I'd like to talk about the effective field theory approach overall and show how it calculates the quantum effects at ordinary energies, at energies like this, you know, scales where meters, we're not fine scales, not enormous scales. And show you that that has the form of an effective field theory. So since I'm treating this as a colloquium, I'll explain what an effective field theory is along the way. The effective field theory is a standard technique. What it does is it takes the quantum calculations you're doing and focuses on what's important, what's effective. The word effective, it means what is the effective degree of freedom at that scale. And it shifts the focus from, in gravity, it shifts the focus from the ultraviolet, the high energy, to ordinary scales where you can do the calculation. And in a way, I view it as the completion of a program that goes back a long ways to when I started quantizing gravity. In the past, much of the focus has been on the high energy end, the divergences. But the divergences are the part that are the least reliable part of the theory. The reliable part is the low energy. And effective field theory focuses you down to where you know what the theory is. So, let's start with a question I always ask my quantum mechanics class. Why do quantum mechanics calculations work in general in any theory? And the problem is that when you do perturbation theory in quantum mechanics, you're instructed to sum over all states. And physics is an experimental science. We only know some of the states that are exist in nature. We know them up to some energy level. And surely there's things beyond that which we don't know. And so if you have to sum over all states, how can you sum over the ones you don't know? It's incomplete knowledge. How can you do any quantum calculation? So the typical response is, well, there's an energy denominator that cuts things off. It's not true. It grows with energy, in fact. Perhaps the matrix element to high states doesn't couple. That's not true either. Basically, anything that has any coupling constant dependence couples also to high energy states. So we have to figure out why we can do this. The answer is the uncertainty principle. The uncertainty principle tells us that the effects that come from very high energies look to us to be local. So they look just like any local term in a Lagrangian. In particular, they look just like masses and coupling constants. And so most of these high energy terms get absorbed into that. And we measure the total mass, and we then measure the effect of that in this coupling constant. So there's this, the key is really this Abelkus-Karazhan theorem, which tells us that all the effects of high energy are either absorbed into coupling constants, that's one thing that could happen, or they're suppressed by powers of the heavy scale. So if this was W exchange, they'd be 1 over MW squared effect at low energy. So the answer to that question, I used to introduce the renormalization program to students. Normally, we first teach renormalizable field theory, where we have a small number of parameters that are sensitive to high energies, and then you only have these coupling constants if you don't allow the other type, the terms that are suppressed by powers of the heavy scale. Effective field theory is just a more general way of doing this, in a sense. You allow terms that are suppressed by the heavy scale, you also allow whole coupling constants. And you treat the quantum effects from the degrees of freedom that you're living at. Okay? So we went through one of the key steps already, or at least part of it, the fact that high energy effects are local when you look at low energies. The corollary is also important. Low energy effects are not local. So if you think of photon exchange or loops where you would get cuts and magnetic parts and loops, all those are non-local effects. So the distinguishing feature is that you have local terms which are can incorporate all the high energy effects, and but local terms are not enough because the low energy quantum effects are distinct from that, and you have to separate them out. So this is the process of effective field theory. The second step in this in effective field theory is the idea of an energy expansion. If you're going to allow more terms than just the normalizable field theory, you need a way to organize your calculation because there's a large number of terms. The other way to organize it is by the energy expansion. If you have terms that are suppressed by the powers of the heavy scale, you organize the predictions in inverse powers of that heavy scale. It's a systematic way of organizing the expansions. But then otherwise, it's just usual field theory. You quantize, you renormalize, the divergences are local, so they go into local terms. And when the dust settles, you can pick out predictions that are distinct from that. That's the process that we're going to go through here. So the general process is identify the Lagrangian. In this case, it'll be easy. It's general relativity plus corrections. We calculate and we normalize. And then you have to do some, figure out what the predictions are. And that's what I'll walk you through for this particular case. So there's a really, really, really well worked out example of this process for nonlinear, non-renormalizable Lagrangians. That's chiral perturbation. There's the whole community out there that does this. There's the low energy limit of QCD has a symmetry, chiral symmetry, that requires the pions and kaons to be almost massless. And the way the symmetry is organized, it relates different numbers of pion and couplings. And so the Lagrangians that characterize that symmetry carry a nonlinear form. So if you look up there, the pion field is contained in an exponential of a matrix, and the Lagrangians contain terms. So here's a term with two derivatives of that exponential matrix. Here's one with four derivatives of it. And so there's the power. This is organized in a power. An energy expansion, this is the lowest energy piece, that's the next energy piece, et cetera. And this is a full experimental program. You know, there's experiment, phenomenology, we know the symmetry breaking, all sorts of stuff. I'd like to show this little calculation. It's not the best, most precise calculation, but what I'd like to show in this context is it comes almost purely from loops. There is no direct photon neutral pion coupling. So if I take two photons to two neutral pions, it's possible that there's no coupling in the theory that has. So these parameters up there don't occur. It only comes through loop couplings, and eventually the high enough energy parameters enter into the game. But anywhere down below here, it's pure predictions. So you can do it in degrees with experiments, and experiment works there. You can see the nature of the energy expansion. The first term goes off, violates unitarity here, and then the second term corrects it. So there's all sorts of nice things you can put there. But my point is basically, here's a perfect, really, really non-normalizable field theory that's easy to do quantum correction. So we think many of our theories as effective field theories that they're going to have new theories beyond them. Let's not focus on that at the moment. What I'd like to do is now turn to general relativity as an effective field theory. General relativity in quantum mechanics, of course, there's this long-standing issue of do they fit together. But effective field theory refocuses how you ask the question. Both general relativity and quantum mechanics are known over ordinary scales, you know, from here to here. Are they incompatible on those scales? Or are they only incompatible on scales beyond which we've probed, experimented, beyond which we have experimental knowledge? There's a big difference in those two. In one case, you can make predictions over these scales, quantum mechanics and general relativity go fine together, and then there's something else that needs to be added later on. So what we do is we need to take general relativity and put it into this framework and show you how you do this separation of low energy and high energy. So here's just the start. So like I said, you organize the Lagrangian in an energy expansion. Well, the Einstein action has, the curvature has two derivatives in it. There's two derivatives on the metric. And so the only thing that's really important to follow in this little segment here is following the derivatives. Just like you did with the pion theory back there, the derivatives give you the energy expansion. More derivatives is more factors of the energy. So the lowest order term that you can have is, of course, a constant. Then you can have two derivatives, four derivatives, six derivatives, etc. So let's imagine we're allowing all of those, and we'll look for low energy predictions. You have to go out and measure the parameters. The constant term is, of course, the cosmological constant. It's extremely tiny. If we're doing this, working this out, in complete generality, we would keep that as a leading term. But on ordinary scales, it's irrelevant, so I'm going to drop it. Okay? I think it's an interesting feature to talk about how it fits in. But on ordinary scales, it's irrelevant. The second term is, of course, Newton's constant. The next order terms with curvature squared modify the predictions of general relativity on very short scales. They're essentially unconstrained. Those coefficients there, in most, the expectation, the dimensionless coefficients, the expectation is that they'd be of order one. The bounds that you put on from experiment are that they're less than about 10 to the positive 7. So if they were 10 to the positive 60, they would have no measurable effect by many orders. So there are
these R squared terms. In some scenarios, I think that the benefits want to go for the Hubble constant. And when you say at the beginning of the universe, then the squared is equal to H4,
yeah.
And the H4 comes from the Hubble from the R.
So in the beginning of the universe, I would say, well, I'm not discarding them, I'm keeping them.
Okay.
Okay. I'd rather not discard them. In fact, you'll see that they're a part of the framework. Okay. I'd like to keep them. But on ordinary scales, the point is their effect is small. And we'll actually see why it's small in a minute, in the fact that you may not come back to it.
So what about the Asian value formulation?
What?
Asian value formulation. If you have other terms in the background, then you won't have the same Asian value formulation as the general relativity.
You mean the early universe?
No, not the early universe, just mathematically. No. You give GIJ and it's pi and pi ij, and make it whole. If you have higher order terms, you probably have to give more derivatives than pi. So, my question would then be, if that's the case, is it clear that it's going to be close to general relativity?
I think it is clear, yes. When you're working at small curvatures, the effects that you're talking about are small effects compared to them. So the place where it falls apart is we'll come back and talk to you, is when the next terms are parallel to the first ones.
Yeah, because then your higher derivative theories are unstable.
Okay, and all the, let me come back to that, there are the slide on that. If you can also add non-renormalizable terms to matter Lagrangian, so there are terms here that it's not very important for what I'm doing. So now let's imagine it. So we've now written out the Lagrangian. We imagine trying to start quantizing it. It's the quantization itself is not awesomely difficult. The technique, the best of the techniques at this stage would be using the covariant quantization in the background field method to develop interpretive quantization. If you're making predictions at low energies, you're in fact interested in expanding around some about flat space in this room, some Walker in the universe. But you do that. You imagine perturbative corrections around some fixed background and expand the theory in the quantum field. One of the advantages of doing this is that the results end up preserving the symmetries of general relativity, so that when you renormalize, you have terms that are generally covariant. The theories of gauge theory needs gauge fixing. I'm going to always use harmonic gauge, and there are associated ghost fields, which are vector anti-commuting fields that run into the Feynman to which ghost fields. So the Lagrangian comes out in some form. I've written out the quadratic terms there. You can read often that the propagators, at least around symmetric spaces, and the one I've written down here is around flat space. And the calculation of two is around flat space, so here's all the Feynman's around flat space. They're nothing special except they're messy, especially the triple graviton coupling is messy. But it's nothing particular special aside from being coupled. So we've done two of the steps in this program. We've written out the Lagrangian and quantized the renormalization now. Certainly there are divergences in this theory there by a high energy n. Of course, that's not the place where we're trusting the theory, but nevertheless, you do a calculation, you find these divergences. There's a power counting theorem that parallels what Weinberg did in power perturbation theory, at least if you're doing pure gravity with zero cosmological constant, then each time you do a graviton loop, you get two more powers of the energy and the energy expansion. So one loop gives four powers of the energy, four derivatives, two loops gives six, seven power expansion. So these divergences will look like terms with higher derivatives, and so the parameter for each of them will absorb the divergences into those parameters. So the one loop one was done by Clifton Feldman. Dimensional regularization is certainly the preferred technique here because it again preserves general variance. As advertised, the terms come out looking like in the general Lagrangian R squared terms. You can renormalize their coefficients by suitably adjusting the parameters in the branch. The two loop calculation, at least, has been done for pure gravity, also has the usual effect, the expected effect of six derivatives. And there's a more formal study for whom the expert is around here. By Weinberg and Gomez, that shows that even the subtleties of gauge theory don't throw off this power counting and this renormalizability property. I won't go into that detail here, but in practice, you can carry it out and see that it works. Okay, but this is all. I've just been churning at this stage because I haven't gotten anything out. The divergences are not predictions of the theory. They come from the part of the theory that we don't trust. The parameters in the Lagrangian, C1 and C2, they're not predictions. They presumably depend on whatever the ultimate high energy theory is. So they're not a prediction. So then you have to turn to the other end of the spectrum. So we've looked at the high end of the spectrum. What about the low end? What's distinct about the low end? Well, what you want is you want terms that have effects that are distinct from the general Lagrangian. They can have a couple forms, but the most common one, the ones that I'm going to focus on here, are ones that are non-analytic in the momentum. So log of Q squared or square root of Q squared. Those are things that can't occur in the Lagrangian. You can't have them. You can't have the square root of or the logarithm of two derivatives. So these are things that couldn't be part of that local Lagrangian. They come only from long distance propagation, and we'll show you twice that's how it comes. So these are types of things that could be predictions. So let's turn to the calculation. That's all the setup, the calculation. What calculated the Newtonian potential, the definition of potential of the relativistic theories, of course, has some subtleties. This ours is just the scattering potential, which is the Fourier potential and the scattering matrix. So if you wanted to use it in the Schrodinger equation, you'd do something slightly different. At lowest order, it's, I think everyone here probably can accept this easily. You just take one graviton exchange, do the non-relativistic risk reduction, and you get this particular Newtonian potential. But then the interest is what goes beyond that. So let's try to get to the answer before, or the form of the answer before we do the calculation. Let's look at what the type of expansion we can expect. We're doing the long distance behavior, so we're interested in powers of off, correct? There is a classical expansion parameter, gm over r, that labels the nonlinearities of general relativity, but it's a classical, there's nothing to do with quantum mechanics. If you want something that's to do with quantum mechanics, you'd like a power of h-bar in there. So let's put a power of h-bar, and we'll put a power of g because we're going to do quantum loops with gravitons, which automatically give you the power of g. Then the unique expansion parameter is this gh-bar over r squared c cubed. So that's the type of term that we look for if we're interested in a quantum correction. We'll also find another type which is this short range piece, the delta function up there. That comes out naturally out of the calculation. But it's a delta function, so it's short range. So what do we then look for when we do the calculation? Well, if we go to momentum space, just like Fourier transforming backwards, you can see that some of the terms that I pointed out to you already come into play. The 1 over r goes to 1 over g squared, of course, standard. The classical expansion parameter corresponds to a square root of g squared in momentum dependence, one power. The h bar piece up there, the quantum piece, corresponds to q squared log q squared. So basically, if you see this, the q squared cancel, the log q squared Fourier transform gives you that 1 over r cubed. And then, of course, you know that you expect, since this is a momentum expansion, that you're going to get the q squared piece. Q squared does, of course, show up. And then the q squared cancels q squared, gives you that delta function that I said we want to also find. So anything that's just analytic, meaning just the power of q squared, is then short range. So that's what we're going to look for. If you, at this stage when you're thinking, hey, you can already see that the answer is going to be parameter free. It's going to be free of divergences. And the logic here is the following. The logic is that we showed you that the divergences go like r squared. The parameters also go like r squared. R squared goes like 2 to the 4th. When you take the page of summons, because it's four derivatives. Let's put q to the fourth into this term. The way you put an r squared term in for a high energy particle loops has the same effect. You have 1 over q squared, q to the fourth, 1 over q squared, gives you the constant piece, which is the delta function. So these constants, the c1 and the c2, give you effects that are short range, effectively delta function to low enough energy. Okay. And in a sense, that's where the balance is. Okay, so here we've got a nice separation. All the short range stuff is in the analytic. All the long range stuff, or at least some, not all of it, but some of the important long range stuff is in the non-analytic pieces. With that in mind, all you do is just go ahead and calculate. Take the Feynman rules, plug away, it's painful. But the results fall out after you correct all your mistakes. So I just had picked to show you a couple of the terms. The labeling, perfect, it's this term and that term, just as an example of what the edges for that one looks like. The first one, the one that had an extra propagator in there, had both classical and quantum. The other term that I have second was only the quantum piece. And once you do the calculation, you can tell which one's going to come out of the ball. So that's, then you get your info. There's the answer. So that's the foundation, at least in one calculational scheme. So you're just looking at the long distance propagation in a loop vector. So, comments. First comment is, at this stage of the talk, I very often get asked, how come I found a classical correction in a one loop diagram? Because most people in field theory classes are taught that the loop expansion is an expansion in H bar. It's not true. I'll come back to the other things in a minute. That's a folk theorem, and the folk theorem is wrong. And this is a good counterexample. You, in fact, get out the classical effect out of a one-loop calculation. And the point is that most of those, there is an overall H-bar when you do a loop diagram. That's true. But there are kinematic dependences inside of loop diagrams that can change that answer. And the one we just saw there was we had a squared and Q-squared over Q-squared. So I had a 1 over Q-squared here. Dimensionally, it looks like this. Has a 1 over h bar in it. That cancels the h overall h bar in the loop diagram. And there's a lot of examples that we pulled out, we wrote it up just because we'd always run up needing the same thing. Just make sure.
What about QED?
Yeah, QED, I'll show you an example that I think my time will be okay to show you the example. It's one that makes it very understandable what's going on in that case. Right. So, that's first question, comment is the classical piece. And the classical piece had been previously calculated quite a long time ago by just the same technique. They calculated the same diagrams, and they showed that the classical correction, the nonlinear correction in general relativity, emerges from that. So it was a beautiful calculation. And if they thought a little bit harder, they could have done the quantum piece at the same time. Second comment is that the quantum correction is unmeasurably small. That's a shame. We would love to see it. If you take two objects, one Fermi apart, which is about as close as we can do, that second term compared to the quantum term compared to the one is 1 part in 10 to the 4th. But that's really a success. That's the success, because when you do perturbation theory, you want your corrections to be small. And the failure perturbation theory is when your corrections are big. So this is the best perturbation theory known to man. It's not the worst, it's the best, because the corrections are the smallest. But I think the more important point is that there's a procedure and a well-behaved calculation that shows doesn't show any secret concept. There is a long history of this, some of which has mistakes, and some of which just has different potentials, and some of which have both. I can review that outside of the lecture. I should go back right now. Which was visiting here in the audience. One of the people who got things right along with us. But I find the interesting thing is the fact that it wasn't done 30 years ago. It could have been done 40 years ago. And I think the effective field theory program deserves the credit for that. It's really this reasoning that allowed us to realize that it's a calculable quantity. When we're in the face of the difficulties of quantum mechanics in terms of
relativity. Okay. Question?
Sure.
When you do weak interactions and portfolio,
yeah.
you used to do a lot of calculations before coming down to the formation, right? Yeah, so it's a similar situation.
Yeah, but of course, that's right. So we've learned to do things more systematically than we did before. So what I'd like now to do is I'd like to actually just show you another way to do the whole calculation. This isn't turned out yet, but and I'm going to do the reverse of the usual thing. I'll give you the motivation less. But if you're interested in just what goes into the calculation, here's another way to look at it. What I'm going to do here is instead of, like I just previously got, I got classical effects out of doing loops. Here I'm going to get quantum effects without doing loops. And this is a technique where you can get out the quantum effects by multiplying the other three amplitudes for the graviton one shell. I think that might be interesting to people who are doing gravity things. So the technique uses a dispersion relation, some special sum rules, which in the old days were thought to be more general, more powerful than perturbation theory. Back when perturbation theory was particularly suspect, they relied on causality and process symmetry, general low energy properties that field theories have. They don't necessarily rely on perturbative expansion, but of course, a modern person would say, "Well, all the perturbative diagrams satisfy this, so therefore it's a good general property." And of course, the calculation will give the same answer because perturbative diagrams do satisfy it. But nevertheless, it's interesting to just think about it. So the technique, in general, you can, for these scattering amplitudes, you can write out these dispersion relations where the amplitude is generated by the cuts. Cuts are where you go on physical on-shell states. So instead of going off-shell, you have just the on-shell states. The at low energies, left-hand cuts and short-range effects, which don't play a role. You're just interested in a spectral function, which is the dispersion relation is basically in the momentum transfer, key. And you calculate these spectral functions by taking the process of just looking what the intermediate states are on shell. I'll do it for you in a minute. But the way you get the pieces out that we're interested in is you look right at threshold. So it's only at t is equal to zero that you're interested in. And here t is equal to zero, one finds by doing the calculation that you get root t, a constant plus height of the terms of power expansion. And that then converts into these square roots and logs, which in turn turn into the classical and quantum corrections. So you can pick these things out by going just the low energy end of the dispersion range. So the equivalent of the renormalization issues that you have to do in other theories come at the high energy end, and you can deal with those by doing subtractions. So instead of doing the dispersion relation with no subtractions, if the high energy behavior is bad, you do one subtraction, which is this line, two subtractions, which is this line, which has the effect of killing off the high energy ends of this. And you can keep doing as much as you want. You can do any number of subtractions you want. Non-analytic terms, the terms we're interested in, only come from the end at zero here and are completely independent of that. And these just give these an expansion in q squared, which are the equivalent of these coefficients in the effect of Lagrange. So this technique, instead of having a Lagrange in there with coefficients, you have subtraction constants, which come from the high energy end of the theory, and by taking enough subtractions, you're just sent to the low energy. So it's another way of thinking about the theory. You're on shell, and you just need to know the low energy end. So this was done for EML, and that's where we found the technique written down in the most useful form by Feinberg and Tucher. So what do? Your on shell states, if you're doing electromagnetic scattering, it's just constant scatter. So you take photons hitting charged particles any possible way. Constant amplitude at low energies is well known. It has low energy theorems. It's nice to behave. You multiply together two constant amplitudes. Well, you integrate over some angle in the center of mass. and you get out the coefficients and you get the potential. So we can do the same thing for gravity. Again, all you need to know is the low energy graviton scattering amplitude. So the gravity scattering over matter at the lowest possible energies. And that's a slightly more complicated calculation, but it's easily doable. You multiply them together, you integrate, and you get the same answer. So it's one reason we did it is just because it's a nice check. If you go through the algebra is so wildly different from the other calculation that we did. But you get the same answers is quite a check. Here's the motivation. My motivation is not to get the same number again by yet another painful way, but is to try to prove the universality. Because the low energy theorems have universal properties. For example, for E&M, Weinberg proved that the low energy limit of Compton scattering is universal independent of spin. The E1 transition dominates, and there's a fixed tensor structure, and all the spin complications drop out, and so everything has the same feature. So it makes it look like the low energy limit of the electromagnetic amplitude is universal, and all the calculations that have been done so far. We've been doing them for gravity, we've been doing some of the other spins, they seem to be universal too. Can we prove that? It seems, we haven't really got out of all the eyes, so I wouldn't say that there's still a question mark up there. But it seems quite logical that the low energy amplitude satisfies these universality properties. There's some factorization theorems. And then all spectral functions would have the same low energy limit and the same classical and quantum correction. So that's the motivation. Let me skip that unless someone asks. Here's another calculation. This is one that comes down a little bit. This is an E&M calculation. Where you're doing sort of the same thing. We're doing the correction to the metric, but the metric around charged particles and the particles in the loop are going to be photons, not gravitons. So gravity is just standard old classical gravity here. What we're doing with photons. And the same counting goes as before. So you can get, if you know the energy momentum potential for photons, you can form find the metric. And if you look at what terms you can get in the energy momentum tensor, so there's a 1 over q squared from the propagator, you can get corrections of square roots, q squared, logs, etc., and the expansions that you get are then power down by powers in just the same way as we did in scattering amplitude. Here we're doing photon loops. Okay. So here we do the photon loops. There's all the diagrams, all the loop diagrams of photons. It's a standard QED calculation. And the answer is you get the Schwarzenegger metric classical in this expansion. You get the classical pieces and the quantum pieces. Okay? And you get quantum corrections to the spin dependent pieces. So there's another calculation done in the same sort of way. I actually put this in partially because I think it illustrates something. Remember, we were getting classical effects from loops. We can, in this case, we can trace back and see where those classical effects come from. This is very simple in this case. And the classical effects, what we've done in the calculation is the energy momentum tensor around a charged particle, once you're away from the origin, is in the electric fields that sit outside. So the energy momentum carried by the electric field. That has a power law fall off. And it's that power law fall off that when you process the calculation goes exactly to the classical corrections. So when we're doing these diagrams here, the effects come from the electric field outside of the particles sitting out there at R. Gravity feels that, and the loop calculations are just reproducing what you know is that there's a classical field at the particle. So it's a simple explanation of why the loop has to give you the class budgets. You can do the same thing for Schwarzschild. This is what I call an incomplete quantum calculation because the quantum metric isn't a well-defined concept. It's calculation is well-defined, here's the answer. Same techniques. Another one that's fun is graviton scattering. This is done by Dunbar and Norwich, where they did it using string-based methods, but just by taking low energy limit of strings there you get out the graviton pieces. But it has the same features as usual. It has the logs, there's some powers, there's logs. There's none of these constants, C1, C2, it's obvious that it should be finite. There are, however, one over epsilon terms here, which, however, are infrared effects, and when you add graviton radiation to the process, just like you have to do in ordinary field theory, you see, you're not radiated plus tree, amplitudes, all those cancel beautifully, you get a finite effect that has, you know, the typical expansions that you expect. I think it is a very beautiful result. It's the low energy theorem of quantum gravity. No matter what your asymptotic completion is, this is the low energy theorem. And it's advertised his work on quantum radiation, which I think is a nice way to do quantum radiation in an effective field theory. That's the local limit of the Green's function, the flux in the Green's function surrounding a black hole. We'll defer the discussion. What I do want to talk about, though, is the limits of this effective field theory. We've seen that the amplitudes grow like powers, sometimes powers times logs, but logs grow slowly. The format that of the quantum corrections is that they grow like G-squared. So this is clearly not a theory that you can extend the effective theory, you can't extend beyond the Planck scale. Jonathan Simon has done some nice work, which answers one of John's questions here, of the sicknesses of R plus R squared theories. He checked to make sure that all of those sicknesses come from beyond the Planck scale. So if there is a sensible completion beyond the Planck scale, they're no longer sicknesses. So the effective field theory predicts that it breaks down at that scale, and presumably there's a more complete theory needs to replace it. There is one difference which I never get much response from discussing, but I'd like to do it here since again some people are interested in the general questions. There's one way that this is different from other effective field theories that we know. In other effective field theories, they only get better as you take more and more infrared effects, more infrared limits. However, it's possible in to think of situations in general relativity where we run into a little trouble in the extreme infrared, particularly because of the ubiquity of singularities in general relativity. So if you just take the lowest order theory, you find in general most space-time there's singularities. These singularities are places where the effective field theory breaks down. And what I just don't know how to do, I don't know if it's a serious problem or not, is I don't know how to do calculations that move past a singularity. So that, you know, some past black hole, for example, take a little bitty black hole, and try to look the quantum effects on two sides, and I don't know how to do that. Because the effective field theory isn't good in that neighborhood. My expectation is that there are comparable things that exist in terror perturbation theory, like baryons are regions where the effective field theory breaks down. You treat them as separate sources, and then you need some boundary conditions. I just don't know how to do it. But that's the only distinction that I know from every other effective field theory that that exist. It's just that there are regions where we expect the theory to break down that occur quite naturally. So, this is where it reformulates the problems. What I call the old view is that quantum mechanics and general relativity are not compatible. And if they were both not compatible over the same range of energies from here to here, that would be shocking. I think that doesn't seem to be the case. The new view is that the problems that occur at the higher energies, and we need some completion of the theory at higher energies. So that's much less shocking because it's not a fundamental conflict. It's just like we are in other theories, we have incomplete knowledge. So I like to throw these a few dueling quotes out. Just these are fun. Here's Ed Witten. So we come to a key puzzle. The existence of gravity clashes with the description of the rest of physics as by quantum fields. That, I would say our evidence is not in favor of that. So Frank Wilczek at the Dual Backs has a lot of portentous dribbles written about quantum theory of gravity. There's a perfectly well-defined quantum theory of gravity that agrees accurately with all available experimental data. Now, the agrees with all experimental data is Wilczek's sense of humor. But the perfectly well-defined quantum theory of gravity is a state. That's a real state. And I assume that what he means by that is that you try to quantize general relativity and perturbative treatments at low energies. It works fine because if I try comparing with data, I get effects that are smaller than all existing data. Here's a longer version of the same thing. So this is Bjorkane questioning whether there is no theory of gravity. It's true that there's no closed theory, none is valid of all energies. But as an open theory, it's our best quantum theory, not our worst. That was my earlier joke also. It's the best preserved theory at all. And as he goes on to describe the effect of field theory treatment, and then says that it's credible over so many orders of magnitude, more than we expect any of our other theories to be credible. We expect other theories to break down before them. So another thoughtful quote, which I tend to agree with. So what do we use this for? Unfortunately, I'm a phenomenologist by it at heart. I love to connect it to data. I don't see at present a good way to connect it to measure quantities. There's some ideas connected with photon propagation because that goes through a lot of gravitational fields, and there's various null theorems of general relativity. So if you see a difference from zero, maybe you can see something. I haven't come up with it yet. It's possible that we can compare with numerical methods or models that approach the low energy limit. I like the idea of trying to study singularity theorems. Some of the Hoffman-Penrose theorems may be violated as you approach the singularity by the nature of quantum mechanics. It's possible that could be done in the region where the effective field theory makes sense. So I'm going to summarize it this day because I'm a little early. I've been trying to make the case that we have a quantum theory of gravity, where it has the form of a theory, that, type of theory that we know and use in other contexts, effective field theory. That effective field theory has a range of validity. It tells you it breaks down at certain energies. But the corrections in its realm of validity seem very well behaved. The predictions are due to the propagation of the massless degrees of freedom. They come from just having general relativistic couplings and gravitons. And it doesn't answer all our questions. In fact, most of the questions that many of you find the most interesting come from the high energy limit because the perturbative corrections are small. those questions need a more complete theory. But nevertheless, that complete theory will have, if it's correct, will have this as the low energy limit, and will then kill these quantum predictions, the low energy.
So the message is that if we sit around and construct some general motherhood theory of quantum gravity or background and finite, we won't learn anything of observation about until we get to the finite.
Well,
which is very hard to get.
That's right, it's hard to get. You might learn things in the region of singularity, so black hole evaporation is something that this doesn't address. That's a property of the high energy. It doesn't necessarily require you to do an experiment with Planck's. But that's because the curvature is obviously the singularity.
So the theory won't produce anything different from this.
The question is whether the other part of the answer is there can be breakdowns of the effective theory before you get to the Planck scale, if the theory has another scale in it. So if the theory becomes 10-dimensional at 1 dB, then the effective theory breaks down at 1 dB on the Planck scale.
So I would like to come back to the question when you add the extra terms.
Yeah.
Because I think it's the case that the field equations are often no longer than the second order, then they become fourth order, something like that. So I just did a calculation, and you told me this, so you simulate these things. So what I do is I just have the ordinary action, 1/2 m q dot squared, and then you add a small term, k half an acceleration squared. And what you see then is that even if you say that this k is very, very small, the solutions grow exponentially. So they would actually be very, very different than the ordinary Newtonian solutions, which are just straight lines. So, I mean, there has to be some theorem for this to be true, because you were saying the solutions would be similar. But even in Newtonian theory, that seems not to be the case.
Well, I mean, I think what I should do is have you read Jonathan Simons. Mm-hmm. Jonathan Simons is a relativist who addressed in relativistic language the sicknesses of our star square theories, and show that unless you access the on the Planck scale, they're not sicknesses of the effective theory.
Okay.
Okay. So that's. Now, I can't go for each one, but I think that's my favorite reference because I like the fact the way it didn't.
Because, I mean, the solution space just looks completely different. I mean, in the one you just give as initial data position and velocities, and this you have to give position, velocities, and accelerations, and also boundaries of accelerations. And it's very non-trivial that you should have solutions that look similar. And in fact, in Newtonian theory, these small, if you initially the solutions are similar, the difference grow exponentially in just in the Newtonian theory. So it would be interesting to see a clear map that happens in general theory.
To answer these questions,
it's a common. Yeah. So there's this big difference between doing calculating scattering amplitudes and then solving the initial value problem in classical field theory that makes it sort of puzzling. I would just like to, and I don't claim to understand it too well, I just want to point out you could study these issues in theories that were simpler than gravity. You could study something like QED, or some scalar field theory, field form theory, just see how the higher derivative, if you have higher derivative, higher derivative correction terms, then see.
If the spiral theories are well studied, then. The chiral theories are well studied. They have fourth order equations just like
the classical field.
Yeah.
Yeah, so even something that you know classical.
I maybe I can say something about that. It's true that in the higher derivative theories, you have if you treat the higher derivative terms as part of the unperturbed theory, then you have more solutions, and two of the solutions are singular as the coefficient of the higher derivative term goes to zero, and two of them go to the ones that would have been there in the two derivative theory. But the way that the effective field theories are constructed is, by definition, you're defining your effective theory to agree with full theory order by order in 1 over the heavy mass scale squared. So you're defining an agreement in perturbation theory. And so you're never taking these higher derivative terms to be in your unperturbed Hamiltonian. They're always in the perturbed part. And so you're explicitly constructing the solutions that are perturbatively close to the derivative theory in the definition of the theory. Because you're defining the effective terms in your Lagrangian order by order in perturbation theory. And so because of that, you're never running into these problems with the ghost, because you're never treating these higher derivative terms as being part of the unperturbed thing, which is giving you these, you know, you did, from which you're going to do the initial data problem where you're going to find your ghosts and whatever.
So what you're seeing in this new talk is the case is that even though it's very close initially, perturbatively very close, these differences grow exponentially. So, but I think maybe we can...
It's abilities are exponentially growing moments, but it can be very dangerous.
But the point is that these theories, these effective field theories, are designed to capture, you have some full theory which is stable, say, and doesn't have these growing moments, and the effective field theory is capturing the physics of the full theory. If you, in principle, you could take the full theory, calculated the answer as an arbitrary function of the heavy mass, and then at the very end of the day, Taylor expanded one of the mass, and that would give you some approximation to the answer. And you're designing this effective theory to capture that Taylor expansion before doing all the work to finding the solution. And so you're constructing a theory which is designed to capture the low energy limit of a theory which doesn't have these runaway modes. And so the runaway modes are all artifacts that never arrive, because the way you're using this higher order theory is specifically as a perturbative approximation to a more fundamental theory, which doesn't have them.
Can you say more about how these fit into Weinberg scenario?
Oh,
that's the
safety
that you mentioned.
I'm actually not sure which one to comment about it.
Because here your perturbation is usually around the ocean piece point, let's say. Yeah. But there's claims that the theory might have no ocean piece point, and it could be interesting to study the theory around that.
So the cosmological concept, it hasn't been bigger, modifies the way you do the power count in these series. And there's actually an analogy to that that's been worked out in the chiral case also. In that case, electromagnetism upsets the power count. And we've figured out how to do the power counting in a modified formula. We end up having to do a modified power counting. I'm sure that I know how to do it from standard techniques if the cosmological constant is modest size, small like it is in our universe. I don't know, I haven't worked out how I would do this expansion in a theory where the cosmological constant is the dominant energy constant.
When you calculate the vacuum energy, zero point vacuum energy, the quantum field theory also for parallaxism.
Yeah.
It's obviously
there's divergence. In dimension regularization, you actually, with massless loops, you don't see have any vertical divergences with massless loops. You do with massless loops. But then it just gets renormalized to the parameter, so it doesn't tell us anything. Just a parameter of this type of thing that has to be measured. So we define the renormalized parameter, you measure it, it's fine.
So you don't resolve the problem?
I mean, it doesn't resolve the problem. It has nothing to say about the parameter. that's the nature of effective theories. They don't predict the parameters of the Lagrange.
So that's one thing we could hope for, if I model the K gravity theory. Solve the cosmological constant problem.
Well, if there are no more questions, let's thank Peter again.